1970s has, again unwittingly, helped to push omega-3s out of the diet and to elevate levels of omega-6. Besides demonizing fats in general, that advice has encouraged us to move from saturated fats of animal origin, some of which, like butter, actually contain respectable amounts of omega-3s, to seed oils, most of which are much higher in omega-6s, corn oil especially, and even more so after partial hydrogenation. The move from butter, and especially butter from pastured cows, to margarine, besides introducing trans fats to the diet, markedly increased omega-6s at the cost of omega-3s. Thus, without even realizing what we were doing, we dramatically altered the ratio of these two essential fats in our diet and our bodies, with the result that the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 in the typical American today stands at more than 10 to 1. Before the widespread introduction of seed oils at the turn of the last century, the ratio was closer to 3 to 1. The precise role of these lipids in human health is still not completely understood, but many researchers are convinced that these historically low levels of omega-3, or conversely, historically high levels of omega-6, bear responsibility for many of the chronic diseases associated with the Western diet, including heart disease and diabetes. Population studies suggest that omega-3 levels in the diet are strongly correlated with rates of heart disease, stroke, and mortality from all causes. For example, the Japanese, who consume large amounts of omega-3s, most of it in fish, have markedly low rates of cardiovascular disease, in spite of their high rates of smoking and high blood pressure. Americans consume only a third as much omega-3s as the Japanese and have nearly four times the rate of death from heart disease. But there is more than epidemiology to link omega-3 levels and heart disease. Clinical studies have found that increasing the omega-3s in one's diet may reduce the chances of heart attack by a third. What biological mechanism could explain these findings? A couple of theories have emerged. Omega-3s are present in high concentrations in heart tissue, where they seem to play a role in regulating heart rhythm and preventing fatal arrhythmias. Omega-3s also dampen the inflammation response, which omega-6s tend to excite. Inflammation is now believed to play an important role in cardiovascular disease, as well as in a range of other disorders, including rheumatoid arthritis and Alzheimer's. Omega-6s provide the building blocks for a class of pro-inflammatory messenger chemicals involved in the body's rapid response reaction to a range of problems. One of these compounds is thromboxane, which encourages blood platelets to aggregate into clots. In contrast, omega-3s slow the clotting response, which is probably why populations with particularly high levels of omega-3s, such as the Inuit, are prone to bleeding. If there is a danger to consuming too much omega-3, bleeding is probably it. The hypothesis that omega-3 might protect against heart disease was inspired by studies of Greenland Eskimos, in whom omega-3 consumption is high and heart disease rare. Eskimos eating their traditional marine-based diet also don't seem to get diabetes, and some researchers believe it is the omega-3s that protect them. Adding omega-3s to the diet of rats has been shown to protect them against insulin resistance. The same effect has not been duplicated in humans, however. The theory is that omega-3s increase the permeability of the cell's membranes and its rate of metabolism. Hummingbirds have tons of omega-3s in their cell membranes, big mammals much less. A cell with a rapid metabolism and permeable membrane should respond particularly well to insulin, absorbing more glucose from the blood to meet its higher energy requirements. That same mechanism suggests that diets high in omega-3s might protect against obesity as well. So why is it, as Susan Allport writes, that populations, when given the choice, will naturally drift toward foods with lesser amounts of omega-3s? Because a faster metabolism increases the need for food and therefore the possibility of hunger, which is a much less agreeable condition than being overweight. Allport suggests that this might explain why so many groups have adopted Western diets as soon as they get the chance. It should be said that researchers working on omega-3s can sound a bit like Dr. Edward Casaubon in Middlemarch, hard at work on his Key to All Mythologies. Likewise, omega-3 researchers seem to be in possession of a theory of everything, including happiness. The same population studies that have correlated omega-3 intake to rates of cardiovascular disease have also found strong correlations between the amount of omega-3 in the diet and the incidence of depression, suicide, and even homicide mortality. Some researchers implicate omega-3 deficiency in learning disabilities, such as attention deficit disorder as well. That omega-3s play an important role in mental function has been recognized since the 1980s, when it was found that babies fed on infant formula supplemented with omega-3s scored significantly higher on tests of both mental development and visual acuity than babies receiving formula supplemented only with omega-6. Could it be that the problem with the Western diet is a gross deficiency in this essential nutrient? A growing number of researchers have concluded that it is, and they voice frustration that official nutritional advice has been slow to recognize the problem. To do so, of course, would mean conceding the error of past nutritional advice, demonizing fats in general, and promoting the switch to seed oils high in omega-6. But it seems likely that sooner or later the government will establish minimum daily requirements for omega-3. Several other governments already have, and perhaps in time, doctors will routinely test us for omega-3 levels the way they already do for cholesterol. Though maybe they should be testing for omega-6 levels as well, because it's possible that is the greater problem. Omega-6s exist in a kind of zero-sum relationship with omega-3s, counteracting most of the positive effects of omega-3s throughout the body. Merely adding omega-3s to the diet, by taking supplements, say, may not do much good unless we also reduce the high levels of omega-6s that have entered the Western diet with the advent of processed foods, seed oils, and foods from animals raised on grain. 9% of the calories in the American diet today come from a single omega-6 fatty acid, linoleic acid, most of it from soybean oil. Some nutrition experts think that this is fine. Omega-6s, after all, are essential fatty acids too, and their rise to dietary prominence has pushed out saturated fats, usually thought to be a positive development. But others strongly disagree, contending that the unprecedented proportion of omega-6s in the Western diet is contributing to the full range of disorders involving inflammation. Joseph Hibbeln, the researcher at the National Institutes of Health who did population studies correlating omega-3 consumption with everything from stroke to suicide, says that the billions we spend on anti-inflammatory drugs such as aspirin, ibuprofen, and acetaminophen is money we're spending to undo the effects of too much omega-6 in the diet. He writes, "The increases in world omega-6 consumption over the past century may be considered a very large, uncontrolled experiment that may have contributed to increased societal burdens of aggression, depression, and cardiovascular mortality." Of all the changes to our food system that go under the heading the Western diet, the shift from a food chain with green plants at its base to one founded on seeds may be the most far-reaching of all. Nutritional scientists focus on different nutrients. whether the problem with modern diets is too many refined carbohydrates, not enough good fats, too many bad fats, or a deficiency of any number of micronutrients or too many calories. But at the root of all these biochemical changes is a single ecological change. For the shift from leaves to seeds affects much more than the levels of omega-3 and omega-6 in the body. It also helps account for the flood of refined carbohydrates in the modern diet and the drought of so many micronutrients and the surfeit of total calories. From leaves to seeds, it's almost, if not quite, a theory of everything. From food culture to food science. The last important change wrought by the Western diet is not, strictly speaking, ecological, at least not in any narrow sense of the word. But the industrialization of our food that we call the Western diet is systematically and deliberately undermining traditional food cultures everywhere. This may be as destructive of our health as any nutritional deficiency. Before the modern food era, and before the rise of nutritionism, people relied for guidance about what to eat on their national or ethnic or regional cultures. We think of culture as a set of beliefs and practices to help mediate our relationship to other people. But of course, culture, at least before the rise of modern science, has also played a critical role in helping to mediate people's relationship to nature. Eating being one of the most important manifestations of that relationship, cultures have had a great deal to say about what and how and why and when and how much we should eat. Of course, when it comes to food, culture is really just a fancy word for mom, the figure who typically passes on the food ways of the group. Food ways that endured only, by the way, because they tended to keep people healthy. The sheer novelty and glamour of the Western diet, with its 17,000 new food products every year, and the marketing power, $32 billion a year, used to sell us those products, has overwhelmed the force of tradition and left us where we now find ourselves, relying on science and journalism and government and marketing to help us decide what to eat. Nutritionism, which arose to help us better deal with the problems of the Western diet, has largely been co-opted by it, used by the industry to sell more nutritionally enhanced processed food and to undermine further the authority of traditional food cultures that stand in the way of fast food. Industry greatly amplifies the claims of nutritional science through its advertising and, through its sponsorship of self-serving nutritional research, corrupts it. Several studies have found that when industry funds nutrition research, the conclusions are more likely to produce findings favorable to that industry's products. The predictable result is the general cacophony of nutritional information ringing in our ears and the widespread confusion that has come to surround this most fundamental of creaturely activities, finding something good to eat. You would not have bought this book and read this far into it if your food culture was intact and healthy. And while it is true that most of us unthinkingly place the authority of science above culture in all matters having to do with our health, that prejudice should at least be examined. The question we need to ask is, are we better off with these new authorities telling us how to eat than we were with the traditional authorities they supplanted? The answer by now should be clear. It might be argued that at this point we should simply accept that fast food is our food culture and get on with it. Over time, people will get used to eating this way, and our health will improve as we gradually adjust to the new food environment. Also, as nutritional science improves, we should be able to ameliorate the worst effects of this diet. Already, food scientists are figuring out ways to micro-encapsulate omega-3s and bake them into our vitamin-fortified bread. But I'm not sure we should put our faith either in food science, which so far has not served us very well, or in evolution. There are a couple of problems with trying simply to get used to the Western diet. You could argue that compared to the Aborigines, say, or Inuit, we are getting used to it. Most of us don't get quite as fat or diabetic as they do. But our adjustment looks much less plausible when you consider that, as mentioned, fully a quarter of all Americans suffer from metabolic syndrome. Two-thirds of us are overweight or obese, and diet-related diseases are already killing the majority of us. The concept of a changing food environment is not just a metaphor, nor is the idea of adapting to it. In order for natural selection to help us adapt to the Western diet, we'd have to be prepared to let those whom it sickens die. Also, many of the chronic diseases caused by the Western diet come late in life, after the childbearing years, a period of our lives in which natural selection takes no interest, though it presumably is strongly selecting against people prone to getting fat at an early age, which diminishes fertility. So we turn for salvation to the healthcare industry. Medicine is learning how to keep alive the people whom the Western diet is making sick. Doctors have gotten really good at keeping people with heart disease alive, and now they're hard at work on obesity and diabetes. Much more so than the human body, capitalism is marvelously adaptive, able to turn the problems it creates into new business opportunities. Diet pills, heart bypass operations, insulin pumps, bariatric surgery. But though fast food may be good business for the healthcare industry, the cost to society, an estimated $250 billion a year in diet-related healthcare costs, and rising rapidly, cannot be sustained indefinitely. An American born in 2000 has a 1-in-3 chance of developing diabetes in his lifetime. The risk is even greater for a Hispanic American or African American. A diagnosis of diabetes subtracts roughly 12 years from one's life, and living with the condition incurs medical costs of $13,000 a year, compared with $2,500 for someone without diabetes. This is a global pandemic in the making, but a most unusual one because it involves no virus or bacteria, no microbe of any kind, just a way of eating. It remains to be seen whether we'll respond by changing our diet or our culture and economy. It is estimated that 80% of type 2 diabetes could be prevented by a change of diet and exercise. So far, it looks like the smart money is on the creation of a vast new diabetes industry. The mainstream media is full of advertisements for new gadgets and drugs for diabetics, and the healthcare industry is gearing up to meet the surging demand for heart bypass operations. 80% of diabetics will suffer from heart disease, dialysis, and kidney transplantation. At the supermarket checkout, you can thumb copies of a new lifestyle magazine, Diabetic Living. Diabetes is well on its way to becoming normalized in the West, recognized as a whole new demographic, and so a major marketing opportunity. Apparently it's easier, or at least a lot more profitable, to change a disease of civilization into a lifestyle than it is to change the way that civilization eats. Part 3. Getting Over Nutritionism. Escape from the Western Diet. The undertow of nutritionism is powerful, and more than once over the past few pages I've felt myself being dragged back under. You've no doubt noticed that much of the nutrition science I've presented here qualifies as reductionist science, focusing as it does on individual nutrients, such as certain fats or carbohydrates or antioxidants, rather than on whole foods or dietary patterns. Guilty. But using this sort of science to try to figure out what's wrong with the Western diet is probably unavoidable. However imperfect, it's the sharpest experimental and explanatory tool we have. It also satisfies our hunger for a simple, one-nutrient explanation. Yet it's one thing to entertain such explanations, and quite another to mistake them for the whole truth, or to let any one of them dictate the way you eat. You've probably also noticed that many of the scientific theories put forward to account for exactly what in the Western diet is responsible for Western diseases conflict with one another. The lipid hypothesis cannot be reconciled with the carbohydrate hypothesis, and the theory that a deficiency of omega-3 fatty acids, call it the neolipid hypothesis, is chiefly to blame for chronic illness, is at odds with the theory that refined carbohydrates are the key. And while everyone can agree that the flood of refined carbohydrates has pushed important micronutrients out of the modern diet, the scientists who blame our health problems on deficiencies of these micronutrients are not the same scientists who see a sugar-soaked diet leading to metabolic syndrome and from there to diabetes, heart disease, and certain cancers. It is only natural for scientists, no less than the rest of us, to gravitate toward a single, all-encompassing explanation. That is probably why you now find some of the most fervent critics of the lipid hypothesis embracing the carbohydrate hypothesis with the same absolutist zeal that they once condemned in the fat boys. In the course of my own research into these theories, I have been specifically warned by scientists allied with the carbohydrate camp not to fall under the spell of the omega-3 cult. Cult. There is a lot more religion in science than you might expect. So here we find ourselves once again lost at sea amid the cross-currents of conflicting science. Or do we? Because it turns out we don't need to declare our allegiance to any one of these schools of thought in order to figure out how best to eat. In the end, they are only theories, scientific explanations for an empirical phenomenon that is not itself in doubt. People eating a Western diet are prone to a complex of chronic diseases that seldom strike people eating more traditional diets. Scientists can argue all they want about the biological mechanisms behind this phenomenon, but the solution would appear to remain very much the same. Stop eating a Western diet. In truth, the chief value of any and all theories of nutrition, apart from satisfying our normal curiosity about how things work, is not to the eater so much as it is to the food industry and the medical community. The food industry needs theories so it can better redesign specific processed foods. A new theory means a new line of products, allowing the industry to go on tweaking the Western diet rather than making any more radical change to its business model. For the industry, it's obviously preferable to have a scientific rationale for further processing foods, whether by lowering the fat or carbs, or by boosting omega-3s or fortifying them with antioxidants and probiotics, than to entertain seriously the proposition that processed foods of any kind are a big part of the problem. For the medical community, too, scientific theories about diet nourish business as usual. New theories beget new drugs to treat diabetes, high blood pressure, and cholesterol. New treatments and procedures to ameliorate chronic diseases, and new diets organized around each new theory's elevation of one class of nutrient and demotion of another. Much lip service is paid to the importance of prevention, but the healthcare industry, being an industry, stands to profit more handsomely from new drugs and procedures to treat chronic diseases than it does from a wholesale change in the way people eat. Cynical? Perhaps. You could argue that the medical community's willingness to treat the broad contours of the Western diet as a given is a reflection of its realism instead of its greed. People don't want to go there, as Walter Willett responded to the critic who asked him why the nurses' health study didn't study the benefits of more alternative diets. Still, medicalizing the whole problem of the Western diet, rather than working to overturn it, whether at the level of the patient or politics, is exactly what you'd expect from a healthcare community that is sympathetic to nutritionism as a matter of temperament, philosophy, and economics. You would not expect such a medical community to be sensitive to the cultural or ecological dimensions of the food problem. And it isn't. We'll know this has changed when doctors kick the fast food franchises out of the hospitals. So what would a proponent of a more ecological or cultural approach to the food problem advise us? How might we plot our escape from nutritionism and, in turn, from the most harmful effects of the Western diet? To Dennis Burkitt, that English doctor stationed in Africa during World War II who gave the Western diseases their name, the answer seemed straightforward, if daunting. The only way we are going to reduce disease, he said, is to go backwards to the diet and lifestyle of our ancestors. This sounds uncomfortably like the approach of the diabetic Aborigines who went back to the bush to heal themselves. But I don't think this is what Burkitt had in mind. Even if it was, it is not a very attractive or practical strategy for most of us. No, the challenge we face today is figuring out how to escape the worst elements of the Western diet and lifestyle without going back to the bush. In theory, nothing could be simpler. To escape the Western diet and the ideology of nutritionism, we have only to stop eating and thinking that way. But this is harder to do in practice, given the treacherous food environment we now inhabit and the loss of cultural tools to guide us through it. Take the question of whole versus processed foods, presumably one of the simpler distinctions between modern industrial foods and older kinds. Jorg Skrinis, who coined the term nutritionism, suggests that the most important fact about any food is not its nutrient content, but its degree of processing. He writes that whole foods and industrial foods are the only two food groups I'd consider including in any useful food pyramid. In other words, instead of worrying about nutrients, we should simply avoid any food that has been processed to such an extent that it is more the product of industry than of nature. This sounds like a sensible rule of thumb until you realize that industrial processes have by now invaded many whole foods too. Is a steak from a feedlot steer that consumed a diet of corn, various industrial waste products, antibiotics, and hormones still a whole food? I'm not so sure. The steer has itself been raised on a Western diet, and that diet has rendered its meat substantially different, in the type and amount of fat in it as well as its vitamin content, from the beef our ancestors ate. The steer's industrial upbringing has also rendered its meat so cheap that we're likely to eat more of it more often than our ancestors ever would have. This suggests yet another sense in which this beef has become an industrial food. It is designed to be eaten industrially too, as fast food. So plotting our way out of the Western diet is not going to be simple. Yet I am convinced that it can be done, and in the course of my research, I have collected and developed some straightforward and distinctly unscientific rules of thumb, or personal eating policies, that might at least point us in the right direction. They don't say much about specific foods, about what sort of oil to cook with, or whether you should eat meat. They don't have much to say about nutrients or calories either, though eating according to these rules will perforce change the balance of nutrients and amount of calories in your dinner. I'm not interested in dictating anyone's menu, but rather in developing what I think of as eating algorithms. Mental programs that, if you run them when you're shopping for food or deciding on a meal, will produce a great many different dinners, all of them healthy in the broadest sense of that word. And our sense of that word stands in need of some broadening. When most of us think about food and health, we think in fairly narrow nutritionist terms, about our personal physical health and how the ingestion of this particular nutrient or rejection of that affects it. But I no longer think it's possible to separate our bodily health from the health of the environment from which we eat, or the environment in which we eat, or for that matter, from the health of our general outlook about food and health. If my explorations of the food chain have taught me anything, it's that it is a food chain, and all the links in it are, in fact, linked. The health of the soil, to the health of the plants and animals we eat, to the health of the food culture in which we eat them, to the health of the eater, in body as well as mind. So you will find rules here, or algorithms, concerning not only what to eat, but also how to eat it, as well as how that food is produced. Food consists not just in piles of chemicals. It also comprises a set of social and ecological relationships, reaching back to the land and outward to other people. Some of these rules may strike you as having nothing whatever to do with health. In fact, they do. Many of the policies will also strike you as involving more work, and in fact they do. If there is one important sense in which we do need to heed Burkitt's call to go backward or follow the Aborigines back into the bush, it is this one. In order to eat well, we need to invest more time, effort, and resources in providing for our sustenance, to dust off a word, than most of us do today. A hallmark of the Western diet is food that is fast, cheap, and easy. Americans spend less than 10% of their income on food. They also spend less than an hour a day preparing meals, and little more than an hour enjoying them. In 1995, Americans spent 27 minutes preparing meals and 4 minutes cleaning up after them. In 1965, the figure was 44 minutes of preparation and 21 minutes of cleanup. Total time spent eating has dropped from 69 minutes to 65, all of which suggests a trend toward pre-packaged meals. For most people, for most of history, gathering and preparing food has been an occupation at the very heart of daily life. Traditionally, people have allocated a far greater proportion of their income to food, as they still do in several of the countries where people eat better than we do, and, as a consequence, are healthier than we are. Compared to the 9.9% of their income Americans spend on food, the Italians spend 14.9%, the French 14.9%, and the Spanish 17.1%. Here, then, is one way in which we would do well to go a little native. Backward, or perhaps it is forward, to a time and place where the gathering and preparing and enjoying of food were closer to the center of a well-lived life. This book started out with 7 words and 3 rules. Eat food. Not too much. Mostly plants. That I now need to unpack, providing some elaboration and refinement in the form of more specific guidelines, injunctions, sub-clauses, and the like. Each of these 3 main rules can serve as category headings for a set of personal policies to guide us in our eating choices without too much trouble or thought. The idea behind having a simple policy like avoid foods that make health claims is to make the process simpler and more pleasurable than trying to eat by the numbers and nutrients, as nutritionism encourages us to do. So under eat food, I propose some practical ways to separate and defend real food from the cascade of food-like products that now surround and confound us, especially in the supermarket. Many of the tips under this rubric concern shopping and take the form of filters that should help keep out the sort of products you want to avoid. Under mostly plants, I'll dwell more specifically and affirmatively on the best types of foods, not nutrients to eat. Lest you worry, there is, as the adverb suggests, more to this list than fruits and vegetables. Last, under not too much, the focus shifts from the foods themselves to the question of how to eat them. The manners, mores, and habits that go into creating a healthy and pleasing culture of eating. Eat food. The first time I heard the advice to just eat food, it was in a speech by Joan Gussow, and it completely baffled me. Of course you should eat food. What else is there to eat? But Gussow, who grows much of her own food on a flood-prone finger of land jutting into the Hudson River, refuses to dignify most of the products for sale in the supermarket with that title. In the 34 years I've been in the field of nutrition, she said in the same speech, I have watched real food disappear from large areas of the supermarket and from much of the rest of the eating world. Taking food's place on the shelves has been an unending stream of food-like substitutes, some 17,000 new ones every year. Products constructed largely around commerce and hope, supported by frighteningly little actual knowledge. Ordinary food is still out there, however, still being grown and even occasionally sold in the supermarket. And this ordinary food is what we should eat. But given our current state of confusion, and given the thousands of products calling themselves food, this is more easily said than done. So consider these related rules of thumb. Each proposes a different sort of map to the contemporary food landscape, but all should take you to more or less the same place. Don't eat anything your grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. Why your grandmother? Because at this point your mother is probably as confused as the rest of us, so we need to go back at least another generation, to a time before the advent of most modern foods. Depending on your age and your grandmother, you may need to go back to your great or great-great-grandmother. Some nutritionists recommend going back even further. John Yudkin, a British nutritionist whose early alarms about the dangers of refined carbohydrates were overlooked in the 1960s and 1970s, once advised, "Just don't eat anything your Neolithic ancestors wouldn't have recognized, and you'll be okay." What would shopping this way mean in the supermarket? Well, imagine your grandmother at your side as you roll down the aisles. You're standing together in front of the dairy case. Your grandmother picks up a package of Go-Gurt portable yogurt tubes and has no idea what it could possibly be. Is it a food or a toothpaste? And how exactly do you introduce it into your body? You could tell her it's just yogurt in a squirtable form, yet if she read the ingredients label, she would have every reason to doubt that that was in fact the case. Sure, there's some yogurt in there, but there are also a dozen other things that aren't remotely yogurt-like. Ingredients she would probably fail to recognize as foods of any kind, including high fructose corn syrup, modified corn starch, kosher gelatin, carrageenan, tricalcium phosphate, natural and artificial flavors, vitamins, and so forth. And there's a whole other list of ingredients for the berry bubblegum bash flavoring, containing everything but berries or bubblegum. How did yogurt, which in your grandmother's day consisted simply of milk inoculated with a bacterial culture, ever get to be so complicated? Is a product like Go-Gurt portable yogurt still a whole food? A food of any kind? Or is it just a food product? There are, in fact, hundreds of foodish products in the supermarket that your ancestors simply wouldn't recognize as food. breakfast cereal bars transected by bright white veins representing, but in reality having nothing to do with milk. Protein waters and non-dairy creamer. Cheese-like foodstuffs equally innocent of any bovine contribution. Cake-like cylinders with cream-like fillings called Twinkies that never grow stale. Don't eat anything incapable of rotting is another personal policy you might consider adopting. There are many reasons to avoid eating such complicated food products beyond the various chemical additives and corn and soy derivatives they contain. One of the problems with the products of food science is, as Joan Gussow has pointed out, that they lie to your body. Their artificial colors and flavors and synthetic sweeteners and novel fats confound the senses we rely on to assess new foods and prepare our bodies to deal with them. Foods that lie leave us with little choice but to eat by the numbers, consulting labels rather than our senses. It's true that foods have long been processed in order to preserve them, as when we pickle or ferment or smoke, but industrial processing aims to do much more than extend shelf life. Today, foods are processed in ways specifically designed to sell us more food by pushing our evolutionary buttons, our inborn preferences for sweetness and fat and salt. These qualities are difficult to find in nature, but cheap and easy for the food scientist to deploy, with the result that processing induces us to consume much more of these rarities than is good for us. Tastes great, less filling could be the motto for most processed foods, which are far more energy dense than most whole foods. They contain much less water, fiber and micronutrients, and generally much more sugar and fat, making them at the same time, to coin a marketing slogan, more fattening and less nutritious. The grandma rule will help keep many of these products out of your cart. But not all of them. Because thanks to the FDA's willingness, post-1973, to let food makers freely alter the identity of traditional foods that everyone knows without having to call them imitations, your grandmother could easily be fooled into thinking that that loaf of bread or wedge of cheese is in fact a loaf of bread or a wedge of cheese. This is why we need a slightly more detailed personal policy to capture these imitation foods. To wit, avoid food products containing ingredients that are A, unfamiliar, B, unpronounceable, C, more than 5 in number, or that include D, high fructose corn syrup. None of these characteristics, not even the last one, is necessarily harmful in and of itself, but all of them are reliable markers for foods that have been highly processed, to the point where they may no longer be what they purport to be. They have crossed over from foods to food products. Consider a loaf of bread, one of the traditional foods that everyone knows, specifically singled out for protection in the 1938 imitation rule. As your grandmother could tell you, bread is traditionally made using only a remarkably small number of familiar ingredients. Flour, yeast, water, and a pinch of salt will do it. But industrial bread, even industrial whole grain bread, has become a far more complicated product of modern food science, not to mention commerce and hope. Here's the complete ingredients list for Sara Lee's soft and smooth whole grain white bread. Wait a minute. Isn't whole grain white bread a contradiction in terms? Evidently not anymore. Enriched bleached flour, wheat flour, malted barley flour, niacin, iron, thiamine mononitrate, vitamin B1, riboflavin, vitamin B2, folic acid, water, whole grains, whole wheat flour, brown rice flour, rice flour, rice bran, high fructose corn syrup, hello, whey, wheat gluten, yeast, cellulose. contains 2% or less of each of the following: honey, calcium sulfate, vegetable oil, soybean and or cottonseed oils, salt, butter, cream, salt, dough conditioners, may contain one or more of the following: mono and diglycerides, ethoxylated mono and diglycerides, ascorbic acid, enzymes, azodicarbonamide, guar gum, calcium propionate, preservative, distilled vinegar, yeast nutrients, monocalcium phosphate, calcium sulfate, ammonium sulfate, cornstarch, natural flavor, beta-carotene, color, vitamin D3, soy lecithin, soy flour. There are so very many things you could say about this intricate loaf of bread, but note first that even if it managed to slip by your grandmother, because it is a loaf of bread, or at least is called one and strongly resembles one, the product fails every test proposed under rule number 2. It's got unfamiliar ingredients. Monoglycerides I've heard of before, but ethoxylated monoglycerides? Unpronounceable ingredients. Try azodicarbonamide. It exceeds the maximum of 5 ingredients by roughly 36, and it contains high fructose corn syrup. Sorry, Sara Lee, but your soft and smooth whole grain white bread is not food, and if not for the indulgence of the FDA, could not even be labeled bread. Sara Lee's soft and smooth whole grain white bread could ably serve as a monument to the age of nutritionism. It embodies the latest nutritional wisdom from science and government, which in its most recent food pyramid recommends that at least half our consumption of grain come from whole grains, but leavens that wisdom with the commercial recognition that American eaters, and American children in particular, have come to prefer their wheat highly refined, which is to say, cottony soft, snowy white, and exceptionally sweet on the tongue. In its marketing materials, Sara Lee treats this clash of interests as some sort of Gordian knot. It speaks in terms of an ambitious quest to build a no-compromise loaf, which only the most sophisticated food scientist could possibly cut. And so it has with the invention of whole grain white bread. Because the small percentage of whole grains in the bread would render it that much less sweet than, say, all-white Wonder Bread, which scarcely waits to be chewed before transforming itself into glucose, the food scientists have added high-fructose corn syrup and honey to make up the difference. To overcome the problematic heft and toothsomeness of a real whole-grain bread, they've deployed dough conditioners, including guar gum and the aforementioned azodicarbonamide, ingeniously simulating the texture of supermarket white bread. By incorporating certain varieties of albino wheat, they've managed to maintain that deathly but apparently appealing Wonder Bread pallor. Who would have thought Wonder Bread would ever become an ideal of aesthetic and gustatory perfection to which bakers would actually aspire? Sara Lee's Mona Lisa. Very often, food science's efforts to make traditional foods more nutritious make them much more complicated, but not necessarily any better for you. To make dairy products low fat, it's not enough to remove the fat. You then have to go to great lengths to preserve the body or creamy texture by working in all kinds of food additives. In the case of low-fat or skim milk, that usually means adding powdered milk. But powdered milk contains oxidized cholesterol, which scientists believe is much worse for your arteries than ordinary cholesterol, so food makers sometimes compensate for this by adding antioxidants, further complicating what had been a simple one-ingredient whole food. Also, removing the fat makes it that much harder for your body to absorb the fat-soluble vitamins that are one of the reasons to drink milk in the first place. All this heroic and occasionally counterproductive food science has been undertaken in the name of our health. so that Sara Lee can add to its plastic wrapper the magic words, good source of whole grain, or a food company can ballyhoo the even more magic words, low fat. Which brings us to a related food policy that may at first sound counterintuitive to a health-conscious eater. Avoid food products that make health claims. For a food product to make health claims on its package, it must first have a package. So right off the bat, it's more likely to be a processed than a whole food. Generally speaking, it is only the big food companies that have the wherewithal to secure FDA-approved health claims for their products and then trumpet them to the world. Recently, however, some of the tonier fruits and nuts have begun boasting about their health-enhancing properties, and there will surely be more as each crop council scrounges together the money to commission its own scientific study. Because all plants contain antioxidants, these studies are guaranteed to find something on which to form a health-based marketing campaign. But for the most part, it is the products of food science that make the boldest health claims, and these are often founded on incomplete and often erroneous science, the dubious fruits of nutritionism. Don't forget that trans-fat-rich margarine, one of the first industrial foods to claim it was healthier than the traditional food it replaced, turned out to give people heart attacks. Since that debacle, the FDA, under tremendous pressure from industry, has made it only easier for food companies to make increasingly doubtful health claims, such as the one Frito-Lay now puts on some of its chips, that eating them is somehow good for your heart. If you bother to read the health claims closely, as food marketers make sure consumers seldom do, you will find that there is often considerably less to them than meets the eye. Consider a recent qualified health claim approved by the FDA for, don't laugh, corn oil. Qualified is a whole new category of health claim introduced in 2002 at the behest of industry. Corn oil, you may recall, is particularly high in the omega-6 fatty acids we're already consuming far too many of. Very limited and preliminary scientific evidence suggests that eating about 1 tablespoon, 16 grams of corn oil daily may reduce the risk of heart disease due to the unsaturated fat content in corn oil. The tablespoon is a particularly rich touch, conjuring images of moms, administering medicine, or perhaps cod liver oil to their children. But what the FDA gives with one hand, it takes away with the other. Here's the small print qualification of this already notably diffident health claim. The FDA concludes that there is little scientific evidence supporting this claim. And then, to make matters still more perplexing, to achieve this possible benefit, corn oil is to replace a similar amount of saturated fat and not increase the total number of calories you eat in a day. This little masterpiece of pseudo-scientific bureaucrat ease was extracted from the FDA by the manufacturer of Mazola corn oil. It would appear that qualified is an official FDA euphemism for all but meaningless. Though someone might let the consumer in on this game, the FDA's own research indicates that consumers have no idea what to make of qualified health claims. How would they? And its rules allow companies to promote the claims pretty much any way they want. They can use really big type for the claim, for example, and then print the disclaimers in teeny-tiny type. No doubt we can look forward to a qualified health claim for high-fructose corn syrup, a tablespoon of which probably does contribute to your health, as long as it replaces a comparable amount of, say, poison in your diet and doesn't increase the total number of calories you eat in a day. When corn oil and chips and sugary breakfast cereals can all boast being good for your heart, health claims have become hopelessly corrupt. The American Heart Association currently bestows, for a fee, its Heart Healthy Seal of Approval on Lucky Charms, Cocoa Puffs, and Trix cereals, Yoo-Hoo Light Chocolate Drink, and Healthy Choices Premium Caramel Swirl Ice Cream Sandwich. This at a time when scientists are coming to recognize that dietary sugar probably plays a more important role in heart disease than dietary fat. Meanwhile, the genuinely heart-healthy whole foods in the produce section, lacking the financial and political clout of the packaged goods a few aisles over, are mute. But don't take the silence of the yams as a sign that they have nothing valuable to say about health. Bogus health claims and food science have made supermarkets particularly treacherous places to shop for real food, which suggests two further rules. Shop the peripheries of the supermarket and stay out of the middle. Most supermarkets are laid out the same way. Processed food products dominate the center aisles of the store, while the cases of ostensibly fresh food, dairy, produce, meat, and fish, line the walls. If you keep to the edges of the store, you'll be that much more likely to wind up with real food in your shopping cart. The strategy is not foolproof, however, because things like high fructose corn syrup have slipped into the dairy case under cover of Go-Gurt and such. So consider a more radical strategy. Get out of the supermarket whenever possible. You won't find any high fructose corn syrup at the farmer's market. You also won't find any elaborately processed food products, any packages with long lists of unpronounceable ingredients or dubious health claims, nothing microwavable and, perhaps best of all, no old food from far away. What you will find are fresh, whole foods picked at the peak of their taste and nutritional quality, precisely the kind your grandmother or even your Neolithic ancestors would easily have recognized as food. Indeed, the surest way to escape the Western diet is simply to depart the realms it rules. The supermarket, the convenience store, and the fast food outlet. It is hard to eat badly from the farmer's market, from a CSA box, community-supported agriculture, an increasingly popular scheme in which you subscribe to a farm and receive a weekly box of produce, or from your garden. The number of farmers' markets has more than doubled in the last 10 years to nearly 5,000, making it one of the fastest-growing segments of the food marketplace. It is true that most farmers' markets operate only seasonally, and you won't find everything you need there. But buying as much as you can from the farmer's market, or directly from the farm when that's an option, is a simple act with a host of profound consequences, for your health as well as for the health of the food chain you've now joined. When you eat from the farmer's market, you automatically eat food that is in season, which is usually when it is most nutritious. Eating in season also tends to diversify your diet, because you can't buy strawberries or broccoli or potatoes 12 months of the year. You'll find yourself experimenting with other foods when they come into the market. The CSA box does an even better job of forcing you out of your dietary rut, because you'll find things in your weekly allotment that you would never buy on your own. Whether it's a rutabaga or an unfamiliar winter squash, the CSA box's ingredients invariably send you to your cookbooks to figure out what in the world to do with them. Cooking is one of the most important health consequences of buying food from local farmers. For one thing, when you cook at home, you seldom find yourself reaching for the ethoxylated diglycerides or high fructose corn syrup. But more on cooking later. To shop at a farmer's market or sign up with a CSA is to join a short food chain that has several implications for your health. Local produce is typically picked ripe and is fresher than supermarket produce, and for both those reasons it should be tastier and more nutritious. As for supermarket organic produce, it too is likely to have come from far away, from the industrial organic farms of California or, increasingly, China. One recent study found that the average item of organic produce in the supermarket had actually traveled farther from the farm than the average item of conventional produce. And while it's true that the organic label guarantees that no synthetic pesticides or fertilizers have been used to produce the food, many, if not most, of the small farms that supply farmers' markets are organic in everything but name. To survive in the farmers' market or CSA economy, a farm will need to be highly diversified, and a diversified farm usually has little need for pesticides. It's the big monocultures that can't survive without them.